Good morning, everyone. Sandell podcast number 59. Today is part three of a mini series we've been doing here on Sandell about foundation companies, which is the legal structure underpinning our Sandbox DAO and our SandFam. Also, if there's anyone from Star Atlas DAO or ApeCoin DAO, hello, this is also applicable to you as you are also a foundation company within the Grand Cayman Islands. The scope of the talk today is an analysis of the facts. It's all about transparency, giving our DAO community more information and better education so that we can make smart decisions about how we run our DAO. I have with me here two experts in the field, two very well-qualified individuals, Carolyn and Melissa. The disclaimer is none of us represent the Sandbox game or the Sandbox Foundation. We're not your financial legal advisors. Nothing we say is to be taken as financial or legal advice. Carolyn, Melissa, do you agree with that?
Completely.
Absolutely.
So if we say the word SIP, we mean Sandbox Improvement Proposal. If we say the word DAO, we mean Decentralized Autonomous Organization. And if we say the word SandFam, if I use the word SandFam, I'm referring to the Sandbox community, those who participate in the people, product, and purpose of the Sandbox ecosystem. That ecosystem looks a little bit like this. I made it out to be about three sectors: the people, product, and purpose. Everywhere from the gamers to the Sandbox team, the game client to the DAO, the Sandbox white paper, and everything that the leadership has commented on. All that goes together every day, equal that ecosystem. Today's episode is squarely within the DAO, particularly the legal framework behind it. And today I have with me two individuals from Walkers Global, which is an internationally recognized company that provides both legal and company management services. Melissa, Carolyn, welcome. And if you would please give us a little bit of introduction about yourselves.
Thank you so much, Shane. So I am Melissa Lim. I am a partner at Walkers. Walkers is headquartered in the Cayman Islands. It's a law firm. We advise on the laws of the Cayman Islands, Bermuda, BVI, Guernsey, Jersey, and Irish laws. We are the largest Cayman law firm, and I am the co-head of the global fintech and blockchain practice at Walkers.
Wow. Welcome. Thank you, Melissa.
Yeah, I'm not really sure how to follow that, but my name is Carolyn Kelly. I'm an associate in the fintech team at Walkers as well.
Welcome.
Thank
to you
so
both.
Much. Yeah, thank
absolutely.
You so much.
Absolutely. Very happy to be here. So we're going to do a quick 5-minute recap for those of you watching to catch you back up. Sandell 34, Sandell 56, and Sandell 57 is what led us to today, specifically Sandell 34. We first began piecing together what I called the relationship map, trying to figure out who was doing what based on Google searches, all sorts of things I could put together and in the public domain. That looked a little bit like this. I still know I didn't get every single bit of it right, but each day I learn more. I update that as much as I can. Today, we're specifically focusing on, also in Sandell 34, I also talked a little bit about where everyone was in the Sandbox DAO, particularly the legal, the company management services, and how I thought it was strange at first, when I didn't know anything, how most of them were in the same town on the Grand Cayman Islands, specifically Georgetown. And there are many different reasons. I thought maybe it was because it was a small town island feel, or perhaps it was just they were all in the same business district, or maybe they all knew each other. But that ended up not being the case as I moved into Sandell 56, part one of our miniseries. Looking at the acts and regulations for the Grand Cayman Islands, I think it became a lot more clear that it wasn't just because people knew each other or their childhood friends or whatever the case may be, but actually there's some really, really good reasons why you would find a Grand Cayman Island company or law firm or management services to fulfill some of these roles within the foundation company. And it all comes down to licensing requirements, all the very, very particular and professional requirements required for things like management services or director or secretary or legal counsel, management services, all these things that help make a foundation company successful. Some very good reasons why you might find a Grand Cayman Island company or firm to help provide that. We did a deep dive into the regulations in Sandel 56, particularly called it the Reg Stack. So we started first with the Cayman Companies Act, the Foundations Company Law. Then we went into Companies Management Act. We did a reading through all of them and all the notable things that I found, and a few others. The directors, registration licensing law, the companies, the citation of acts of parliament law, the virtual asset service provider act, which I'm very glad we went over because that's part of today's brief, and the securities investment business law, all sorts of stuff we could look into to see what does it mean to be a foundation company. And when we read our documents, such as Articles of Association, Memorandum of Association, Foundation, Limited by Guarantee, all these keywords, these buzzwords, subscriber, even why do we see $50 duty stamp on the actual articles? What do those words actually mean? That's why we went through the Reg Stack. And I tried my hand at what I thought it meant to actually create a company. And after today, I'm going to be updating it even more because I know that some of this is a little bit incorrect, so I'll need to update that after today. And then part two, Sandel 57, we talked to a practicing attorney in the United States and discussed some of the case law that's out there right now, Oki DAO, BZX DAO, Lido DAO, as some other frameworks and opinions going out there, such as the 2017 SEC investigative report, the April 2019 framework that they put out as well, and how different U.S. regulations and statutes, such as the long-arm statute, conducts and effects test, and the Dodd-Frank Act, how that might apply to why we see a U.S. regulator suing a German company, and how that applies to U.S. people. We also went through the comparative nature of DAO LLCs within the U.S., particularly DUNAs, Decentralized Unincorporated Nonprofit Associations, and Limited Liability DAOs. Followed up by an opinion piece, one of which is our two authors today, Global Walkers Global, Cayman Islands Foundation Companies Are a Leading Vehicle for Wrapping a DAO. So that leads to today, part three. We're going to hear a brief from Melissa and Carolyn about foundation companies, DAOs, and virtual assets, followed by a Q&A within the allotment that we can do for the next 40 minutes. So, Carolyn, Melissa, all yours. The slides are ready. Ready for you. Take it away.
Excellent. Carolyn, do you want to start?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Mel. Really, I think probably a good place to start here is what is a foundation company? And so a foundation company, it's an exempted company. It is without share capital, which means it's limited by guarantee. It has no shareholders as it has no shares. It can have shares, but the way we incorporate walkers and to feed into the decentralized community ethos of decentralized autonomous organizations is that we incorporate them without having any shares. It has one member on incorporation, but that member immediately resigns after incorporation, leaving it as this memberless company. And the main reason we form these foundation companies is to act as legal wrappers for the DAO. It's an incredibly flexible and bespoke vehicle. And it was actually introduced, it wasn't necessarily with the intention of, just for sort of blockchain projects. There was, it's sort of a trust and philanthropic purposes. That's why it was sort of introduced, but it's been used to act as the legal wrapper for decentralized autonomous organizations. And it's an incredibly popular vehicle. And that's because, traditional corporate structures are at odds with the protocols community. And obviously the vast majority of blockchain protocols, which have their own custom blockchain, are community projects, many of them with community governance at their core. So those traditional structures require there to be sort of a shareholder or a member if you just had a normal Cayman Islands exempted company, basically, in other words, like an owner. Whereas foundation companies can sort of provide a solution to that problem. They can be structured in such a way that they don't require an owner. And like I said, that is because they can be memberless and instead they can be governed by the DAO. And we can perhaps get onto that a little bit later, but that's in essence what a foundation company is. And I guess why would a DAO wish to use a Cayman entity is probably the next best question. And I think, you know, we are very lucky in the Cayman Islands that we have, you know, very, you know, a government that is fairly crypto friendly. There is regulatory certainty in the Cayman Islands, particularly with, you know, the introduction of the Virtual Asset Service Providers Act. It's a tax neutral jurisdiction, so that's also incredibly attractive. And you know, we are very, very fortunate. We have an incredible blockchain community in the Cayman Islands, which is growing all the time, and that allows for, you know, the community to provide sort of become very sophisticated about this area, about the, you know, the digital asset Web3 space. And that what that means is we have incredibly sophisticated service providers based in the Cayman Islands who, and Shane, you mentioned this earlier, you know, those roles that need to be fulfilled, you know, that the foundation company needs to fulfill, they can be selected from this very sophisticated group of individuals who have great knowledge about this space. So we are incredibly fortunate in that respect. And we've got very passionate people as well, which is obviously very helpful. Cayman Islands entities can also be incorporated on a same-day basis. And also investors just generally are very, very familiar with the Cayman Islands, as it's the sort of leading offshore jurisdiction for investment funds. So I'll probably pause there.
Exactly. And I think, Shane, you were mentioning also, you know, why are they all based in Cayman in terms of the service providers?
Right.
Why are they based in Grand Cayman? Well, just a little bit of geographical knowledge here. So the Cayman Islands is comprised of three islands, but the biggest island is Grand Cayman. And that is where the financial center of the Cayman Islands is located.
I did not know that. Three islands, yeah, so you say?
Exactly. The other two islands are very, very small, with population of maybe 1,000 people or 4,000 people. And it's only in Grand Cayman that you'll find a financial center. And Grand Cayman has about 5,000 people. So if you're wondering why everyone has the same addresses, it is because the financial center is in Grand Cayman.
Well, how about that?
There you go. Exactly. And then in terms of what Carolyn was mentioning before on, you know, just the extremely flexible nature of the Cayman Foundation. Well, the Cayman Foundation company was actually something that Walker's trust partners had worked with the Cayman government on, because our trust partners work a lot on setting up family trusts for high net worth individuals. And these trust vehicles tend to be very flexible, just reflect what the family wants to do with their assets. And under Cayman law, you know, a trust vehicle does not have what we call separate legal personality. So it's the trustee that conducts the, you know, operations of the trust. So these, so there was a need from these clients for actually a corporate vehicle. So they wanted something like a hybrid between a trust and a company. So trust partners then worked with the government to put in place a foundation company, which is a hybrid between a trust and a company, not knowing that eventually foundation companies will become the vehicle of choice for the Web3 ecosystem. So it's been quite interesting how the evolution of the use of a foundation company was initially meant to be for family trusts, and now it's become the key vehicle for Web3.
That makes a lot of sense. And I'm probably not surprised to. So we also looked into Guernsey Purpose Trust and how, and I saw so many similarities, and I thought that sounds like the origination, like a company and a trust put together, like the best of both of them.
Exactly, because then you have a corporate shield, because ultimately is a company, is corporate, and you have separate legal personality because you have a corporate. So that's been the a key difference and an evolution of you know, the just typical trust structure that we had historically.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. I did not know that Grand Cayman Islands was three islands. That makes a lot more sense now. There we go. I have now showing the why would a DAO form Cayman Foundation Company.
Yes. And I think Carolyn had, yes, we're moving on to that one. I think Carolyn, we chat about this one as well. Would you like me to take this one?
Well, I'm happy to, actually. I mean, I think, you know, Mel has touched on it as well with what she's saying about, you know, and we've sort of touched upon it earlier, but, you know, the Cayman Foundation fits with that decentralized ethos. We mentioned about community governance and one of the things is, you know, obviously because it's memberless, it's a very sort of unique and flexible structure. So I think the key things to think about is, you know, a DAO doesn't have separate legal personality. And so, you know, echoing what Mel said, a Cayman Foundation company can be used as a wrapper for that DAO. And the Cayman Foundation company in and of itself has separate legal personality. And what that means is, you know, that Cayman Foundation company can enter into real world contracts that a DAO would not otherwise be able to do. And so that's hugely beneficial for a DAO, particularly one that is growing, has a burgeoning project and wants to, you know, enter into contracts with service providers and grants, you know, developers and lots, you know, various different types of contracts. And so the Cayman Foundation company can act as the vehicle for the DAO. And we say as the legal wrapper for the DAO. That's the sort of terminology we use. And then in addition to that, it has not been tested in Cayman court yet, but it's structured, the Cayman Foundation company is structured so that it provides sort of a shield of liability for the DAO. And that's the hope. And that's what we touched upon in that article that you read, Shane, on, you know, that the Walker's article on LinkedIn, because that was sort of the key, one of the key, you know, areas of concern for people following sort of the Uki DAO case particularly. And then obviously with sort of the Lido DAO judgment as well.
Gotcha. Okay. And next was the timeline of events.
Yeah, I think, Shane, we always talk about, oh, you know, the ideal world, you know, for DAO is all like on-chain transactions. You don't need, you know, a real-world entity as well. But ultimately, there's a lot of, you know, given that we don't actually have the infrastructure at this stage, a lot of stuff is still done off-chain. So that's really two main purposes for forming actual, you know, legal entity to represent a DAO. One for the limited liability protection, and then number two for any like real world transactions where, you know, let's say Ape Foundation or wanted to sponsor an event. Well, you still need to enter into, you know, vendor agreements or sponsorship venue and all of that. But that may not necessarily be all done on chain because you have a real world event that needs real world contracts to be entered into.
Something that I was struggling through was in this bullet here. A DAO does not have a separate legal personality. Does that mean to say it doesn't inherently have, like by itself, a separate legal personality and a foundation company grants it that? Or is that separate legal personality always separate from the DAO?
Okay, so that's what we talk about when we speak to our clients. What is the philosophy they want to adopt? Some clients, they want the Cayman Foundation Company to represent the DAO and be a legal wrapper for the DAO. By doing that, we are hardwiring all the token holder governance mechanics within the memorandum and articles of association of the foundation company. So that is, for example, what was done for Ape Foundation. So that all token holder approvals, voting, all of that is reflected in the Cayman Foundation Company's constitutional documents. So it means that all actions of the DAO, therefore, are actions of the Cayman Foundation. And conversely, all actions of the Cayman Foundation are actions of the DAO. And that is
explains
why
that explains the extensive foundation review it goes through before it goes to vote.
Exactly. So that's why that is the philosophy where, you know, quite a few clients take. The other philosophy is, and it's a very good question, Shane, is that some clients will say, okay, we want our foundation company to be a steward for the ecosystem, but not represent the DAO in terms of be a legal wrapper for the DAO. So no token holder governance mechanics are hardwired into the constitutional documents of the Cayman Foundation. The Cayman Foundation is director-led, but a director will take into considerations any of the approved proposals by the DAO, but it actually doesn't action these proposals if the directors determine not to. So there is some discretion there, because ultimately it's still a director-led foundation. The good thing is, though, for those type of foundations, typically the directors do affect what the token holders vote on. It's just that none of the token holder governance mechanics is hardwired into the constitutional documents of the foundation, because the foundation acts separate and apart from the DAO, but is a steward for the DAO. So that's the philosophy. So we say to our clients, do you want the foundation to represent and wrap the DAO, or do you want the foundation to be a steward acting separate and distinct from the DAO, but also furthering the ecosystem of that protocol or NFT? Or, yeah.
I did not understand that distinction. That is a very important distinction now that you say that. How can I tell when reading the Constitution or the articles or memos?
You can tell immediately by, if you look at the Constitution, whether you have all the token holder governance mechanics in the Constitution or not. So if it doesn't have token holder governance mechanics in the Constitution, it means that it's a director-led foundation with the director taking into consideration, you know, any votes on snapshot and so forth. So that is the big distinction. So you see various, if you look out there, you'll find, yeah, foundation companies with two different types of memorandum and articles of association, one with token holder governance and one without.
Thank you so much for distinguishing that in my brain. I've been confused about that this whole time.
No worries. They just, right. It's like down to the absolute, you know, I call it the philosophy. What is your philosophy?
And we have clients, you know, who go, you know, they pick different approaches to this, right? And so we definitely have those clients who want this sort of steward approach and the, you know, the ad hoc sort of token holder governance, where they, you know, pass certain actions. But I think quite often we see them act as the legal wrapper for the DAO when we are incorporating the token holder governance mechanics set out in the bylaws of the, you know, the bylaws of the foundation company, and then we are amending and restating the memorandum and articles of association to reflect that token holder governance. And like Mel said, you know, the directors are sort of there to enact the will of the DAO, subject to, obviously, they can't do anything that's illegal. So, you know, if the DAO decided for whatever reason they wanted to do something, and that was sort of illegal action, then the directors can refuse, obviously, to do that. But generally speaking, they are there to enact the will of the DAO.
And they're fiduciaries, correct? The directors?
Indeed. They have fiduciary duties and obligations to the foundation company, to act in the best interest of the foundation company, to avoid conflicts of interest,
things of that nature. I was skipping ahead there. This is just so exciting. Okay. All right. We left off with the timeline of events. I was just going to that.
Yeah, no problem at all. Mel, do you want me to just take this one? Or yeah, sure. Okay, so the timeline of events. So I think, you know, from this is obviously the Walker sort of timeline of events. So you might get a sort of different approach with different legal service providers in the Cayman Islands. But in essence, we have to firstly do our sort of client KYC and onboarding checks, which are sort of our internal compliance requirements. We would then sort of, you know, we discuss with the client, we have a kickoff call, we discuss with them about the types of service providers, the types of roles that need to be fulfilled and the service providers in the Cayman Islands. We are seeing sort of lots of service providers also act in the first instance and incorporate Cayman Foundation companies. But if we put that to one side and we go through the entire process from our side, you know, we're looking at then preparing me, once the client has been sufficiently cleared by our compliance team and has been fully onboarded, then, and that's, you know, probably like the labs co or the dev co that we would onboard at that stage, and we would then prepare those incorporation documents. And I think Mel touched upon...
What was that word used? Dev co?
Oh, so the development company, the onshore development company, or the onshore labs company, typically would be our client of record initially when we onboard a Cayman Foundation, when we onboard a client of record in order to incorporate a Cayman Foundation. But then we prepare the incorporation documents. So we prepare the memorandum and articles of association, and we typically, they are director-led. That is most of the powers vest with the directors initially, and then at a later stage we would then look at amending and restating if they're going to, the Cayman Foundation company is going to act as a legal wrapper for the DAO. We would then look at a later stage to incorporate the governance mechanics that's set out in the bylaws. But in the first instance, we prepare that initial M&A along with some stage two ancillary documents. At that point, the Cayman Foundation will need to have selected the service providers that it wants to appoint into the roles, which we can come on and talk about a bit later. So once the Cayman Foundation company has been incorporated and set up, it's then really led by onshore counsel and the client as to when token holder governance and, they want to implement token holder governance. And usually that aligns with, you know, the token generation event. And so at that point, though, they would be the ones preparing the bylaws. So we look to onshore counsel to prepare those. And they set out that, like I said, that token holder governance. And then we prepare the amended and restated memorandum and articles of association, as I mentioned, to reflect that token holder governance. And this is in the example where the foundation company is acting as a legal wrapper as opposed to just being a steward. There's so various commercial agreements.
Process. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Within the Walker Global, advised, or is this always how it goes?
This is pretty standard, right? This is pretty standard. But again, obviously, if the foundation company is not going to act as the sort of the legal wrapper where it's reflecting that token holder governance, and if it's just going to be a steward, then obviously, in terms of
the proceed beyond that, okay.
You might just leave it as a director-led foundation company. That? So, but if the intention is to have that token holder governance baked in, then we would need to amend and restate at the articles to reflect that all of that. And so at that stage also, you know, you're looking at lots of, and this sort of goes alongside the whole process of what we're doing, but, you know, we're looking at there's lots of commercial agreements that may need to be executed, certainly service provider agreements with the secretary mm-hmm. and secretary of registered office and supervisor and the directors. So we'd be looking at that. And also, like opening of bank accounts, and we, that's obviously something that, they want to do fairly quickly. And then, you know, we adopt the amended and restated memorandum articles at that point are then adopted. There's, you know, launch of a native token if that's what the client is intending to do. There may also be an appointment of council members, and we can talk a little bit more about that, but that's kind of really a sort of canter through the timeline of events for a Cayman Foundation company as we do it at Walkers. And I think, you know, on the next slide, I've kind of touched upon those key points about it being director-led articles initially, and therefore, you know, the directors therefore hold those key decision-making powers. And then the token holder governance being set out in full in the bylaws. We review those bylaws. We put, you know, we add in our input from a Cayman Islands legal perspective. And then once they're finalised, we will put that into the amended and restated memorandum and articles association and pass a resolution to adopt those articles and give effect to the governance set out in the bylaws.
When you say token holder governance mechanics, are we talking about the DAO wrapper part of what you and Melissa were referring to?
We're talking about the token holder voting, how they're going to vote, the thresholds, what they're able to vote on, and that's all set out in the bylaws. And then what we do, we review those bylaws, we comment on them from a Cayman Islands legal perspective. And then we amend and restate the initial memorandum and articles of association to reflect the token holder governance that is set out in the bylaws. So if, for example, the token holders have the rights to appoint and remove the director, we would reflect that in our the amended and restated memorandum and articles of association to show that token holders, by token holder vote, have the rights to appoint and remove directors. I'm just using that as an example, but, mm-hmm. you know, that's something that we would look to take across from the bylaws into the memorandum and articles of association.
Yeah, and okay. That's for the DAPA type scenario. As I think Shane was asking, in terms of would we do this for the DAO wrapper scenario? And yes, that's what we would do for a DAO wrapper scenario.
Yeah. So earlier when you mentioned that you had like your director led type foundation companies, yeah. your DAO wrapper types. So if it starts as director led, because that's how you have to form the company, and then you transition to a DAO wrapper scenario, is that token holder led on the slide? That's your transition to the DAO wrapper scenario?
Yes, exactly. It becomes token holder led, right? Because it's a DAO wrapper then, because it's wrapping the DAO and giving effect to the actions of the DAO or the approved proposals of the DAO. So that is the transition that Carolyn is talking about. Because obviously you still need to form the Cayman Foundation as director led. You can't just form a Cayman Foundation with this token holder led. It just doesn't quite work that way. Someone needs to set up the infrastructure first with the director, and then you transition to a token holder led foundation, because you're hardwiring, as Carolyn said, all the token holder governance into the constitutional documents of the foundation.
Yeah, or not, depending on how your client wants to do that. That's exactly. So fascinating. Funcracker he's special counsel from the Star Atlas DAO. He is in the chat. He asks, does the director disappear from the picture entirely in a token holder led situation?
No, it doesn't.
No. Yes, you have to have a minimum of one director appointed under Cayman Islands law. So that is a statutory requirement. And so they do not disappear. And they are the ones that enact the will of the token holder voting.
Yeah, if I recall from reading that, you have to have a secretary, a licensed secretary, you have to have a licensed director, and you have to have a supervisor. Correct?
We will need to clarify what you mean by licensed director, because I recall that earlier in this episode, you mentioned the director's registration and licensing law or licensing act. That is not applicable at all. The director's registration
and licensing. That's why. Okay, great. Got it.
The director's registration and licensing act applies to CIMA regulated investment funds. So it doesn't apply to directors that are appointed to non-regulated Cayman entities. So all Cayman foundations formed to date are not regulated by CIMA, which is the Cayman Islands Monetary Authority, which is the regulator in the Cayman Islands. The reason why they are not regulated by CIMA is because none of them are engaging in any regulated activities. I would say those that Walkers works on anyway. I can't generalize for that you know other law firms may work on. So we work with our clients to make sure that the activities of a Cayman Foundation are not regulated activities. And typically, a Cayman Foundation's activities would be, you know, administer a grant program, hold a treasury of tokens, enter into these real world contracts to, you know, for these grant agreements. You may have the engage consultants, engage in, you know, marketing of the ecosystem. So, you know, these activities are not regulated activities under Cayman law, which means that the Cayman Foundation does not need to be regulated under Cayman law, which means that its director does not need to be registered under the Director's Registration and Licensing Act.
Thank you for clarifying that up.
No problem. However, there's a slight nuance in that, if you are dealing with a director based in the Cayman Islands, and typically we have, you know, service providers in the Cayman Islands who provide directors to Cayman Foundations. It is Walker's view that Dietz companies providing director services must be licensed under the Companies Management Act. So that is a separate legislative regime regulating the provision by companies of persons acting as directors. So that's a separate act, but something to bear in mind as well. So not the Directors Registration and Licensing Act, but the Companies Management Act is what we're looking at.
Got it. And follow up was so does the role of director change during a token holder led scenario?
Their role definitely changed, because when we form a director led foundation initially, you know, director has all encompassing powers to conduct the business of the foundation without any reference to anybody. But once you hardwire all the token holder governance, the director is required to give effect to any approved proposals by the token holders. And the only time, I mean, the director still ultimately has a veto, right? Because if the token holders vote to do something that is, I don't know, illegal, or vote to do something that is a regulated activity, then the director has the ability to then step in and, you know, veto that. Or alternatively, if it's a regulated activity, then propose that maybe a subsidiary be formed under the Cayman Foundation to engage in the regulated activity and keep it, you know, away and separate from the Cayman Foundation. Or alternatively, structure this proposed regulated activity very clearly under a third party, so that, again, the Cayman Foundation does not need to be regulated with the Cayman Islands Monetary Authority. And you might be wondering, why do we structure it this way, that the Cayman Foundation is not regulated with the Cayman Islands Monetary Authority? The reason why is because so far to date, if you check the Cayman Islands Monetary Authority's database, there are no Cayman Foundations registered there. So you really don't want to be the first. I mean, you could be the first if you really want to be. But I suspect that a lot of times when CIMA is dealing with applications to be regulated and registered with them, they do ask a lot of questions about who is the owner, who is the UBO. And given that foundation companies have no shareholders, no owners, I think that will be quite a difficult concept for CIMA to, I suppose, get their heads around. I'm not saying it's impossible. It's just that no one's done it before.
So it might take a longer time. I'm blown away. This is awesome. This is the difference between reading the rules and then trying to piece it together and then seeing how it plays out in real life. I didn't notice that there were no Cayman registered entities registered with CIMA.
Yeah, there are none. So yes, but yeah, you know, we're very happy to answer questions.
Sorry, no Cayman Foundation companies, we should say, not no Cayman entities registered. Yeah, just to be clear. Yeah.
In terms of Cayman VAPS registered, so Virtual Asset Services Providers Act regulated entities, there are definitely those that are regulated with CIMA, but they are typically the Cayman companies, not Cayman Foundation companies.
Got it.
Because, you know, yeah, Cayman companies, Cayman Corps, you know, they have shareholders, right? Just like a typical corp. So.
Okay, so I had the timeline events up, and the next slide was what documents are required to form a foundation company.
Mel, do you want to take this one? I feel like I've done quite a lot of the slides, if you'd like to, or do you want me to take it?
I think, yeah. So this is really, just a documentation exercise when you are wanting to form a foundation company. So if you look on the slides, you have an affidavit that's signed by the subscriber. You have your initial memorandum of association and articles of association, which is a director-led draft, just director-led drafted, just because, you know, you don't have token holders at that stage. And then we have what we call the stage two documents, which are all the ancillary documents associated with the formation. So, you know, just kind of the admin, but important admin, such as, well, who is a director, right? The foundation must have a director. And then we also have other ancillary documents, such as, you know, an undertaking from the subscriber to pay the guarantee on demand in order to pay any in order to pay for the initial share, because a foundation company must be formed with an initial share, even though eventually via the notice of resignation of member, the subscriber then resigns as a member so that the foundation becomes a memberless company or an ownerless company. And then finally, you have your other ancillary document, which is a director's resolutions, which deals with, you know, approval of any director services agreements, approval of any, you know, registered office services agreements, and all the usual standard incorporation formalities. So it's just a documentation intensive exercise. Then once that is done, you have your Cayman Foundation formed, ready to go in terms of opening bank accounts and dealing with counterparties, because I think normally that's the thing. And then once the affidavit and the memorandum of association and articles of association are filed with the Cayman Registrar, the foundation company is formed on the date of filing. So you don't actually have to wait and to receive the stamped formation documents before you commence business. You can actually start conducting the operations of the foundation company upon the date of filing. So that's actually a good nuance to be aware of.
I have so many questions, and I'm going to hold them till the end, because I'm going to go down rabbit holes till afterward you get through all of this.
Okay, so I think moving on to the next slide then, where we're talking about what are the roles to be satisfied. So I think initially we had mentioned before, you need a registered office and a secretary appointed. So it must be the same entity for the foundation company, and that registered office and secretary must be licensed in the Cayman Islands. So effectively, the registered office provides the address in the Cayman Islands, because, you know, a Cayman entity must have an address in the Cayman Islands. And the registered office deals with all the filings with the registrar of companies of the Cayman Islands. The role of the secretary is to provide a notice confirming no breach of Cayman AML laws prior to receipt of any donations or gifts by the foundation company. So that's the set out of the various roles for the formation. And then the other two roles, remaining roles, are on the next slide. I'm going to hand it over to Carolyn.
Sure thing. The directors, as mentioned, there is a requirement to have one, a minimum of one director. That there is no requirement for that director to be Cayman resident. And we often get asked that question. But obviously, wherever the director is situated in whatever jurisdiction, you know, tax and sort of legal advice in that jurisdiction should be sought. You asked the question, Shane, earlier about whether direct, you know, are they fiduciaries, and they do owe fiduciary duties to the foundation company. And what we typically see is we see sort of a mix of independent directors and or sort of founder associated directors. And again, it really depends. And, you know, that sort of founder associated directors will be subject to that onshore legal and tax advice. And, you know, we then review, one of our roles is to look at the director services agreement, and to provide comments from a Cayman Islands legal perspective, on that document. And then that's approved sort of by way of director resolution, once that's been finalized and then entered into between the foundation company and the director. And then the other role that Mel was referring to, so this is a very unique role to Cayman Foundation companies, is the role of the supervisor. So where a foundation company has no members, and which we've established is what, you know, the way in which we use these entities, particularly obviously in the Web3 blockchain space, they must have a supervisor. Again, there's no requirement for that supervisor to be Cayman resident? Again, another question we get asked quite a lot. If the supervisor is not based in this in the Cayman Islands, then, you know, again, onshore legal and tax advice should be sought in relation to any such appointments in that particular in a particular jurisdiction.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that sentence? That was, I need to process that again.
Yeah, no, just that if the directors or supervisor are based in a different jurisdiction, then legal and tax advice should be sought in the jurisdiction in which they are based, just to ensure that there's no sort of adverse legal or tax consequences for both, well, the supervisor themselves, but also for that Cayman Foundation company. And that was just making the point that there's just no requirement for either the supervisor or the directors to be Cayman resident.
Does it get really complicated if the director and the supervisor are outside of the Cayman Islands and they themselves are not in the same jurisdiction?
It becomes a little bit more complicated, I think.
Okay, got it.
I think depending upon, particularly we have seen sort of very anecdotally, and I'm sort of not US law qualified, but, you know, particularly if you have directors who are located in the US, we've seen potential issues there. But again, it's always good in these circumstances that if you are not appointing Cayman Islands based supervisor directors, then you should get the requisite legal and tax advice prior to making those appointments, just to, you know, cover off any issues beforehand.
Got it.
And so, yeah.
I think a lot of tax advisors have said to our clients that they prefer to have Cayman resident directors because they want the mine management of the Cayman Foundation to be in Cayman.
Yeah.
So, a big draw of a Cayman Foundation company is that, you know, Cayman is a tax neutral jurisdiction. So if you are saying then that the mine and management of the Cayman Foundation is in Cayman, therefore the activities are therefore done in Cayman, then there should not be the ability to tax other jurisdictions to tax the Cayman Foundation. And the good thing is the Cayman government does not impose, you know, taxes, because Cayman is a tax neutral jurisdiction. So you're trying to benefit from that tax neutral regime that we have in Cayman.
It's starting to become a little bit more clear to me now when some of the bumper stickers I've seen across many Cayman Islands firms is that how strong the regulatory environment is and how what you mentioned, just the tax jurisdictions, the nuance of that, I think, is starting to become really clear as you speak through these bullet points.
Yeah. The Cayman government does not charge taxes effectively. So no income taxes, no capital gain taxes. So it's a tax neutral jurisdiction. And that's why many international transactions use Cayman entities, not just in the Web3 space, in the investment fund space, really any international financial transactions use the Cayman Islands.
And if you have a U.S. director, then the worldwide tax laws that U.S. have might complicate that scenario a little bit more.
We're not tax advisors, but I think US-based directors, then you are then saying that the mine and management of the Cayman Foundation is in the US, and therefore the IRS will start charging taxes on the Cayman Foundation's treasury.
Fascinating. So if that's you, consult your tax attorney.
Yes, exactly.
At all times.
Exactly. And then one more quick thing I wanted to mention as well, because as you know, Shane, you had mentioned, you know, directors do owe fiduciary duties. And a big thing is conflict of interest. And, we have seen that for some Cayman foundations, that some Cayman lawyers actually act as directors to the foundations that they are Cayman lawyers to. That is something that Walkers does not do, because we believe that is a conflict of interest. So we've been very clear to our clients, if they do ask Walkers, oh, can you also provide directors to the Cayman Foundation? We would say no, because after all, you know, we as Cayman lawyers at the foundation will therefore be acting for the Cayman Foundation. What if the director then breaches his or her fiduciary duties and goes up and, you know, does something wrong? Well, then we would be in a bad position where we're like, okay, we can't to ourselves. So that is why Walkers will not provide directors to a Cayman Foundation.
I can think of at least one DAO that does.
Yeah.
How about
yeah.
that?
So there, okay. Yes. So there are other, we are aware of this practice for other Cayman law firms, but this is something that we do not do because we believe it's a conflict of interest.
Got it.
And actually, building upon that point is, you know, as we were talking about the supervisor and what the supervisor's role is, one of the roles of the supervisor is that it can bring an enforcement action on behalf of the foundation company for the enforcement or the duties or liabilities of the directors. And so when you're looking at it in that context, and what we're starting to see, which is, I think, is can only be a good thing, is the separation of the supervisor and the director roles. Because actually, in the Cayman Islands law, they don't have to be separate. You could have the same person act as the director and also as a supervisor. But on the basis that the supervisor is the one who can bring the enforcement action on behalf of the foundation company against the directors if they breach their fiduciary duties or they don't act in compliance with the memorandum and articles of association and the bylaws, it seems sensible to have the separation between those roles. And we are seeing that more and more.
And I'm sure that's going to bear that out in some way, shape, or form as the case law starts to develop around this.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. So far, it has been untested.
Yep.
so we're high on this.
That's so funny how all this comes together like that. I'm blown away. Keep going.
You're having light bulb moments, Shane. I can see it.
This is so fun and interesting. Okay. All right. Next slide was the bylaws.
Yeah, and we've touched upon this earlier. So this is a separate governance document, and this is what sets out those token holder governance mechanisms, how the directors can vote, what those thresholds are required to make a decision, how token holders can put forward proposals. Obviously, there's your Snapchat, Discord, Twitter Spaces, lots of different types of communication channels. And so really, that's
where you're familiar with those. That's awesome.
Yeah, I'm sure you and all your followers know those incredibly well. That's where the meat of the token holder governance is. You know, if you were going to read something, that is the document you would be reading, which would tell you about how the token holders in a particular community are able to vote on things and what things they're able to vote on. And so they're not filed with the registrar, they're not publicly available. And I think we also mentioned this a bit earlier as well, but the directors of the foundation are bound to follow the bylaws through the memorandum and articles of association. And what we mean is that there is an article within the articles of association which says that the directors must act in compliance with the bylaws and the memorandum and articles of association. And they must implement those approved proposals of the token holders. Again, we refer to that as sort of an act in the will of the DAO, subject to those fiduciary duties and law. So we also mentioned that where, you know, the directors are bound to follow the bylaws and the token holder votes, save for if they were, you know, the token holders had voted to do something that was illegal under Cayman law or any applicable law. So therefore, the directors could have a veto right and say, no, we're not going to enact that proposal. And then I think we sort of mentioned about once the bylaws and the token holder governance is kind of finalised, and we would review that from a Cayman Islands legal perspective, we amend and restate the articles to reflect that token holder governance, so that you get this sort of flow through the documents. And that is the sort of the legal wrap. You're wrapping your DAO through this sort of nexus between those two documents.
I have a question later on that this is probably a rabbit hole, but I noticed that the bylaws are optional in the foundation company's law language. And I'm fascinated to know how that connection is with the transition, but I'll hold that till the end.
Okay.
And the next one was the activities of a Cayman Foundation company.
Yeah. Mel, do you want to take this one?
Yes, I think we kind of mentioned before that really typical activities are that, you know, it could be governance token minting, issuance, it could be private sales or airdrops of the tokens, provided there are no public sales. treasury management of the governance tokens, you have your grant programs or your bug bounty programs, you have your execution of services agreements and consulting agreements, you can have your prop trading of your treasury as well. So all of these activities are not regulated activities. And the reason why we said no public sales is because the public sales of tokens is a regulated activity under Cayman law. So as long as the foundation is limited to, you know, private sales, airdrops, that's fine. If the foundation wants to engage in public sales, then we typically then drop down a BVI subsidiary to engage in any public sales of the tokens, because the public sales of tokens in the BVI, it's not regulated. So the BVI
is not regulated. You're talking regulated by the Securities Investment Business Law, the virtual asset service providers, something else?
Or just not regulated at all.
Okay, got it.
Under the laws of the relevant jurisdiction. So, BVI, okay. The public sales of tokens is not regulated at all under BVI law. So the BVI subsidiary will therefore enter into, you know, agreements with, you know, listing platforms, exchanges, market making agreements, you know, anything to do with public sales of tokens.
And when you say grant program here, are we referring to like the DAO, the voting DAO, like the snapshots and the proposals?
Exactly. These are the proposals.
Got it.
Where grant aid to the approved proposals.
All right.
So I think moving on then is actually down to the key legislative framework that may affect the Web3 space. So the next slide, we're talking about the Virtual Asset Services Providers Act, and also any, you know, AML legislation as well.
AML, the money laundering?
Exactly. Anti-money laundering or know your client KYC legislation.
Got it. Okay.
If a Cayman entity is engaging in virtual asset services, which we will define on the next slide, then that Cayman entity must be regulated with the Cayman Islands Monetary Authority, with CIMA. So I think we had mentioned earlier that there are Cayman entities engaging in virtual asset services, and they are registered with CIMA. So if you look at CIMA's database, you'll find that there are about 19 or 20 VAS regulated entities, and Walkers actually acts for a majority of them. So we know this legislation well. But none of these VAS registered entities or regulated entities are Cayman foundations, because the Cayman foundations are not engaging in regulated activities. As mentioned before, the public sale of tokens or virtual assets will require registration with CIMA, but no one has done it because there's no point, right? Knowing that you can just drop down a BVI sub to do it. So why ever engage in public sales of tokens out of the Cayman Foundation, which will require registration with CIMA, when you can just set up a BVI subsidiary within, you know, 1 or 2 days and do a public sale out of the BVI subsidiary? So
BVI?
In BVI, the public sales of tokens are not regulated.
BDI.
British Virgin Islands.
Oh,
BVI, British Virgin Islands. Okay, got it. Thank you.
Sorry, I'm abbreviating things.
And we have an office there as well, Shane. And so we have colleagues there where this is a pretty simple and very well-trodden path with Cayman Foundation companies. They will just, you know, instruct us to instruct our BVI team to incorporate a BVI subsidiary as a public token issuer.
Got it. And starting to come together. Okay.
Yeah. So it's become market standard now to have a Cayman Foundation company, and then sitting underneath it is the BVI subsidiary that engages in public sales. So that is why we work so closely with our BVI office. So just to reiterate, the private sale of virtual assets do not require registration with CIMA. So It means that the Cayman Foundation can enter into token purchase agreements and, you know, all of that SAFs with counterparties, because that is a private sale, because you have pre-identified the purchaser because you're entering into agreements with them. So that's fine at the foundation company level. I should also mention that with the Virtual Asset Services Providers Act, it was implemented in 2020 for the Cayman Islands. So we have that regulatory certainty since 2020. And people are very, and like the lawyers here are very familiar with it. And so, you know, we can advise on it because it's been around for a long time in the Web3 space, you know, since 2020.
Yeah, I know. Five years is like ancient in the Web3 world.
Ancient. And so the Virtual Asset Services Providers Act in Cayman is actually divided into two stages. The first stage is the registration with CIMA, and the second stage is a more comprehensive licensing regime, which has not been implemented yet, but is expected to be implemented later this year.
Got it.
But that licensing regime is meant to be slightly more onerous in that it will be applying to like custodians and exchanges. So probably not applicable to this, you know, to our audience here, but just something to be aware of, that there will be a licensing regime that will be expected to be slightly more onerous, but we don't really expect it to be too onerous starting later this year for custodians, exchanges. And then finally, we always ask to advise on our AML, sanctions laws, and our regulatory team is very well versed in this and has helped a lot of our clients go through this process. I would add that, again, because the Cayman Foundations are not regulated in the Cayman Islands, they are not engaging in any relevant financial business that requires Cayman Foundations to be complying with the full Cayman AML regime. However, Cayman Foundations are still subject to the sanctions laws. So we advise our clients that, okay, the Cayman Foundations do not need to run like KYC checks on like token holders or anything like that, right? Because it's not subject to the full Cayman AML regime. But at the very least, though, you know, any counterparties the foundation enters into, any counterparties agreements that the foundation enters into, you need to run like sanctions screening, because a Cayman Foundation should not be dealing with a sanctioned person. Otherwise, penalties will apply. And I mean, that's a similar thing to what is already done in the US as well. You know, sanction screening is an important thing to do. And again, we have providers in the Cayman Islands and outside of the Cayman Islands who can do the sanction screening of the counterparty. And then moving on to regulatory, would you like to jump in, Carolyn, or I can continue?
You continue, Mel.
I was flipping through those two slides because you were mentioning the VASP and then AML. So I was slipping through as you were speaking.
Yes, exactly. I was getting ahead of myself, getting very excited.
That's okay.
So,
love the passion.
Yes. Fine then. I mentioned, you know, Cayman entities engaging in virtual asset services must be regulated by CIMA. So virtual asset services is defined to mean the public sales of tokens, as well as the business of providing one or more of the following services on behalf of others. So these are the businesses. That is the exchange between virtual assets and fiat currencies, the exchange between one or more other forms of convertible virtual assets, the transfer of virtual assets, the custody of virtual assets, or the participation in or provision of financial services related to a virtual asset issuance or the sale of a virtual asset. So that is the definition of virtual asset service. Again, typically a Cayman Foundation is not engaging in any of these activities. Therefore, a Cayman Foundation is not required to be registered with CIMA. We always recommend to our clients that, you know, we have that that it is a good idea to get a regulatory analysis done anyway to confirm that the Virtual Asset Services Providers Act does not apply. And a lot of directors on island, independent directors on island, like to have that regulatory analysis done in the form of a memo so that they have that in their pocket. Another one that actually a lot of our clients do ask for is a memo or regulatory analysis that the tokens are not securities under Cayman law. So we're able to provide that memo as well. Some listing platforms ask for that. I know in the US, mm-hmm. no one would ever give memo, but in Cayman, we are able to give such memo because we have that regulatory certainty. And it's very clear most of the time that these tokens are not securities under Cayman law. So a lot of our clients love that memo. Then they'll just hand it over to have whoever they're dealing with, whether it's Binance or anywhere else, and just say, hey, here you go. Our tokens are not securities under Cayman law.
Huh. That's been hugely popular as well, actually.
I can imagine it would be.
Yeah. We've seen a lot of that work coming through.
And then just moving on to the other regulatory regimes that may be relevant. So we talked about AML, anti-money laundering regime. Although in this case, because Cayman foundations are not regulated, then the AML regime actually does not apply to them. But you know, sanction screenings would be recommended because you don't want to be dealing with a sanctioned person, otherwise penalties will apply. Another legislative regime that may be applicable could be the Securities Investments Business Act if the foundation is dealing with securities. But again, most of the time they're not, because the tokens are not securities. So it's unlikely that the Securities Investments Business Act will apply to Cayman foundations as well. Another one to look at that we get a lot of questions about is the Cayman Islands Economic Substance Regime, which is targeting various activities which will require what we call substance in the Cayman Islands. And this was really driven by the OECD. The OECD was very worried about the offshoring of IP. So if a Cayman entity is engaging in the monetization of IP, then the OECD is requiring that Cayman entity must have substance in Cayman. So we advise a lot on that.
What's OECD?
I've abbreviated it so much that I cannot ever remember the full name. Carolyn, can you remember
that? I think it's the Office of Economic Cooperation and Development, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development.
Yes. Yes. So the OECD introduced this economic substance regime across the board. I mean, the last I saw, over 90, even over 100 jurisdictions have adopted this economic substance regime. So there is no way the whole offshoring of IP then is should be minimized. So that's been a big thing. This regime was introduced in Cayman, I can't remember, about maybe 8 years ago now. About over 100 jurisdictions have implemented this OECD requested economic substance regime. So we advise a lot on monetizing IP. We advise a lot on lending, because all these are activities falling under the economic substance regime, which may require substance in Cayman. And then finally, we also have a beneficial ownership regime, but typically the way a foundation company is structured, there are no beneficial owners. So it'll be a register stating, you know, no beneficial owners. And then finally, just to close it off, we talked about, you know, will a foundation company ever be CIMA registered in terms of being a VAS? No, because of the typical activities of a foundation. We had, in some instances, seen a proposed foundation company trying to act as an investment vehicle. And if so, you know, in terms of like investment club DAOs, if so, we probably need to have conversations with the client on whether it falls within the investment funds regime, which is the Private Funds Act or the Mutual Funds Act of the Cayman Islands. And just to close this off, so far, no foundation companies have been registered as mutual funds or private funds as yet. So
for all the ones that are grants programs, they fall outside of this framework?
Yeah, because they're not investment clubs. They're not in. They're not like, I suppose, you know, an investment vehicle is where you have investors coming in, and they have and they get to participate in any profits and losses of the underlying assets of the Cayman entity. A Cayman Foundation with a grant program, they might be giving grants, but they're not expecting anything in return other than, you know, meeting perhaps milestones set in the grant program, in the grant agreement. But you wouldn't say that any token holders has, well, technically, token holders merely have governance rights. They're not entitled to have any say or any share in the profits and losses of the Cayman Foundation's assets. So I suppose any that accrues to the token holder would be the value of its tokens increasing in value, I suppose. But the foundation itself is not an investment vehicle. You know, it's not as if the token holders are saying, hey, I have a share to the foundation's assets.
Okay.
Okay. So that ends our presentation.
Okay, we have 9 minutes before both of us need to conclude. So let's pick out the most important questions that still are on my mind. FinTech, okay. Are these the only conditions? Oh, let's go with phase one to phase two. When you go from a director-led to token-holder-led, bylaws are optional, correct?
Well, yes.
But we would say that if you're going to a token-holder-led, it probably makes sense to hardwire the token holder governance in the bylaws. Because you don't have to file the bylaws with the Cayman Registrar, while you have to file the memorandum and articles with the Registrar. So it becomes a bit more inflexible if you have to, you know, keep making filings, while a bylaws can evolve. So because it's not filed with the Cayman Registrar.
Okay, so you have a lot more flexibility in being able to issue them, change them, whereas if it's a memo or an article, then memory serves, you have to get that changed. So the secretary has to get involved, then you have to report it?
You have to file it with the Cayman Registrar. Okay.
So if you start off with a director-led situation, first of all, are they always director-led in the beginning, or can they be token-led from the beginning, token-holder-led from the beginning?
They can be token-holder-led, Shane, but typically we see a more protracted route to decentralization so that, and we at Walkers, if a client comes to us and says, hey, we've got all of our token-holder governance finalized, we want to do it from day one, which I'm not even sure I've ever really seen, then obviously they can incorporate with token holder governance at the start rather than director-led governance. But typically the way we do it is it's director-led, so the powers vest with the directors. And some of that has to do with speed as well. So you want to get the foundation company incorporated. So if token holder governance is not finalized, then the quickest way to do it, to get the entity incorporated, is to incorporate with director-led articles.
Got it.
Yeah.
And the subscriber, what compels them to resign? What requires them to resign?
It's because, well, the subscriber typically would be, you know, a company management entity that would be the subscriber, because you need to have a subscriber to form a Cayman Foundation company.
Right, right. Mm-hmm.
So they know that they need to resign because a foundation company is meant to be memberless. So the subscriber is the member, right, initial member. And you're dealing with a professional corporate services provider that understands that they've been paid to be the registered office and secretary and the subscriber. They will do that, form the Cayman Foundation, and then they will resign as a member.
So you're relying on their professional understanding and the whole reason why you have them in that role to begin with to fulfill that. But what I'm hearing is that if someone decides to go off the rails and subvert those expectations, there isn't anything requiring them to do that.
Correct. There's nothing requiring them to resign. And that's why you need to pick your service providers carefully. We highly recommend that, you know, you speak to them, interview them, if you're wanting to work to set up a Cayman Foundation. You're going to be working with them.
And why is it so important to become memberless?
I think it really reflects the whole, you know, decentralized ethos you're trying to achieve, because you don't want to be identifying, well, who is a shareholder of this foundation.
Okay. Got it. That's the magic word that I was, okay, now connection made. So the shareholders, got it. Okay. And you already answered, our directors require to be licensed. Thank you. That was in my brain after reading the registration licensing law and all that. And supervisors, they seem like the eyes and ears of, in this case, the DAO members. Would you say that's a fair way to characterize it?
I would say it's yes, in and of the sense that they have the enforcement powers to take actions against the directors for breach of fiduciary duties and non-compliance with the articles and the bylaws. But typically, and this can, you know, can change depending upon the client's wishes, but a supervisor is a sort of quite passive role. So, you know, it's director-led articles, so the powers vest with the director. The supervisor takes a passive sort of backseat role, other than obviously they have the right to bring enforcement action and certain statutory rights, such as the rights to attend and vote at general meetings of the company. But it's typically passive. And so when you say the eyes and ears of the DAO, in the sense of that they can bring enforcement action against the directors for breach, then yes. But they're not sort of there to sort of monitor token holder governance and to make sure any of that's, you know, passed correctly in accordance with the bylaws. But on the token holder side, you know, you sort of look to a DAO administrator to sort of, or the project itself to sort of to organize all of that. But so I would say sort of the answer to that is it depends, but typically passive.
Are we relying on their professional understanding again, or is there something that compels them to be passive? Let's just say we get a very enthusiastic supervisor. Is there something that compels them to be passive or not?
Well, it's the articles of association set out the rights and who has powers to carry out the activities of the foundation company. And so they vest with the directors. So then by virtue of the fact that the powers vest with the directors, they don't vest with the supervisor typically. So they take on a passive role. So it sort of seems oxymoronic, but in effect, that's what it is. So that the powers are, you know, the foundation company is led by the directors until such time as token holder governance is in place, and therefore we move from that director-led into token holder governance.
Similar to that, I read about the restrictions notice power that corporate services providers have. It was in section 265 of the Companies Act. Is that related to this at all?
Yes, it is. The restriction notice relates to the beneficial ownership regime. So effectively, if you are in breach of the beneficial ownership regime, obviously penalties will apply, and a restrictions notice will also be given. However, as mentioned before, typically a Cayman Foundation does not have a beneficial owner. So it literally should be very easy to file that it does not have. So please don't put yourself in a position where you're in a, you know, you might be at risk of penalties and restrictions notice and so forth.
Got it. Okay. We are at pretty much the end of the hour here. So I will speed on through to the very end, where we just got through part three, professional law firm input from our Melissa and Carolyn from Walkers Global. That concludes part three. And Carolyn, Melissa, thank you so much for your time. I thoroughly enjoyed speaking with the two of you. And it's clear that anyone who is doing a foundation company through Walkers Global is clearly in good hands.
Thank you. Thank you, Shane. We really enjoyed this too. And yeah, appreciate all your kind words. It was a very fun podcast to be doing.
Yeah, thanks very much, Shane. It's great. Thanks for inviting us.
Yep, love it. Thank you both for your time. And to all my Star Atlas DAO, ApeCoin DAO, and Sandbox DAO people listening, please take a look at this. What Melissa and Carolyn just did was give some very valuable insight and knowledge into how DAOs are run. And again, thank you everyone for your time and have a great day.